Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Your home for truth in broadcasting.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting today from Copenhagen, Denmark. And with me is, and a lot going on in the world, by the way, George Bush issued another defeat. A federal district court has said, no, that guy is not an enemy combatant. We'll get into that a little more as we go on through the day and all the other things in the news. But right now, Peter Morgenson is with me. He's the chief editor of, is it Politiken?
Yep, that's the name.
And a political commentator. You host your own political debate show on TV2 News.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And you were also from 1997 to 2000. The head of the office and political advisor to the previous prime minister.
Mm, that's correct.
Now, the current prime minister is
Mr. Anders Fogh Rasmussen.
And by the standards of the United States, by the standards of Denmark,
right,
he would be described as a little to the right of center. He's a fan of George Bush's.
Absolutely.
He says taxes should be lowered. Things like this.
Right.
Has gone along with the party, the anti-immigrant party, basically. Hmm. And the previous prime minister, who you were the assistant to, would have been described as more left of center. Do I have that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, basically, in the Danish political society, they categorize themselves the way you explain it. But when it comes to real politics, the difference is not that large, actually.
Yeah.
I would say, in terms of the immigration thing, there is quite a large difference in terms of the previous prime minister. But his party today, if you look at them, they have more or less the same view on that issue as well.
Yeah.
So it's very hard to see the real difference in real politics, so
yeah,
to speak.
We're seeing that in the United States as well. The immigration is becoming the hot issue that on some days seems to split the parties, and on some days, oddly, John McCain, who's our conservative, was the author of a piece of legislation to embrace the immigrants who are in the United States illegally,
right,
and or without documentation. And now he has taken the position, you know, throw the bums out, you know, political expediency or whatever. I mean, it's just
change views.
Yeah, play into nationalism. But here in Denmark, the party of the right, as it were, and I realize that because you have proportional representation, you have a parliament, and the parliament elects the prime minister, and as well as a queen, but she has very little power.
She has no power.
No power. Okay.
Yeah.
so she's the head, but she's the head of state, right? She cuts ribbons and she represents the government. So,
she signs every law.
Yeah. Okay. So
right.
So she has that. Does she have the power to dissolve parliament like the queen does in the UK?
Well, she's a totally individual story here. She doesn't have any relationship to the parliament except she signs the laws. That's
I see. Okay. So it's really a perfunctory thing.
Absolutely.
The party, and so the party on the right, the name of the party is?
Danish People's Party, actually.
The Danish People's Party.
Yeah.
Is, even though in Denmark, you describe them as the party on the right, they're in favor of free college education for people. They're in favor of free national health care for everybody. They're in favor of a national pension system that's quite generous.
Right.
Do I have all that correct?
Absolutely.
Okay, so how is this a right-wing party?
Well, this is right-wing in terms of what you would call the the immigrant issues, actually, almost only. I mean, if the any of you know the magazine The Economist, which is sort of a European, sure, obviously international magazine, every time they describe Denmark, at any case, they will mention that the Danish Prime Minister is supported by the extreme right.
Right.
And that goes specifically to the issue around immigration.
Right.
Actually, when it comes to the rest of the issues, it actually doesn't compete with any of the right-wing parties, including the Prime Minister's party. They compete for the voters with the Social Democratic Party, strangely enough.
Which is the left-wing party.
Which is a center-left, you could call it, and the former Prime Minister's party, actually.
Yeah.
So the reality is that what makes them on the right and what makes them extreme is solely on the immigration issue, really. And they're quite tough on that, I would say.
Yeah. We're talking with Peter Morgensen. How is Danish society and the Danish state politically... Well, actually, before I even get to that, another question that this morning, Louise and I walked through the Christiansborg Palace.
Right.
Or actually, we walked through the remains underneath, you know.
Right,
they go back,
sure,
to the 1100s, to the 12th century.
Yeah.
And the crazy bishop, what was his name?
Absalon.
Absalon, there you go. And I wonder if that has anything to do with the word absolution. I don't know. But Bishop, back when the church and the state were the same thing, basically. And he built this original thing, and the ruins are there. And then over the next 6-8 centuries, Denmark became what is referred to as an absolute monarchy, which is where the monarch actually owns the people, owns the property, owns everything.
Right.
Right. And now here we are, and it's just been less than 200 years since you were an absolute,
sure,
monarchy.
Right.
You are one of the most, by the definitions of the United States anyway, one of the most progressive social democracies in the world. How did that happen?
Well, the reality is that it was a more complex picture about this monarch who owned everything. The reality is the society at the time of where we got our declaration of independence, in the middle of the 18th century, there was a huge pressure from below against the system of this monarchy.
Right.
So he really, I mean, in historical terms, it is known as he gave the power to the people,
right,
but he did not. He was forced to give the power to the people. He gave it to the people at the time, which was the rich people mainly, who was acting in this very, very early democracy.
Now, is this the Mad King?
No, that was not.
He was number six, was the mad one.
Yeah, he was totally very, very mad. But
yeah.
I think basically quite a lot of them have been a little bit mad.
Kind of goes with inbreeding or something.
Well, I don't want to offend the royal family,
yeah,
in current times, but
there
is a very thick stories about this really along the way. The reality is that we have been through in this country since the middle of the 18th century through all the steps of fighting for liberty rights. Things were written down but wasn't really worked out, exactly as you may have experienced in the United States for certain groups of inhabitants.
Sure.
Exactly the same thing has happened here. We have had sort of internal wars, almost small, big incidents for this country, nothing like your civil war, but still the workers has organized themselves.
Yeah.
Fought their way to be a political power, who was taken seriously after a lot of incidents with the put into jail, violence from the police and the right-wing parties and so on. So,
right,
you know, it's very parallel to a lot of other countries in that sense. Your next question will be, of course, how can we become sort of center-left type of country compared to the U.S. With all,
yeah,
the pension schemes and the free schools and all of this?
Yes.
Big answer for that is really that in 1921, I believe, we had the first workers-led government. I mean, really, the workers were organized, and they had the huge impact on the way this society is organized today. And that was where the foundation were made in terms of this very this group of people who are very much alike,
yeah,
being maybe 90% of the population. They organized themselves and
the workers
really, and they made, you know, the rights for them.
They basically rose up and took over.
They rose up and took over, and they were in the majority for a very long time. And what we're seeing today compared to then is simply that there's no more workers left in the old terms. Yeah. So the reality is now if you're right, left, center, doesn't matter. Now you vote for what you the issues at the time you voted in terms of your class. You don't
right.
do that anymore.
Right. We have to take a break in just a few seconds, sure. but I'd like to continue the conversation with you. In the United States, through the 1880s, 1890s, we had the Wobblies, we had the rise of the labor movements, we had then going into the Teddy Roosevelt administration after 1901, we had a president, a Republican president, who was very, break the trust buster. He broke up the big corporations. I'm curious to what extent the actions in the United States might have influenced Denmark, or to what extent Denmark was following a European trend, or whether they were just absolutely going their own way. I mean, you know, what the whole genesis of all this was, and what lessons we might be able to learn from that in the United States. So if we can continue that,
absolutely.
With that point, Peter Morgenson is with us, chief editor of
Politiken.
Okay, and political commentator, host of the show on a political debate show on TV2 News. Maybe we should debate something. It'd be interesting. And a former advisor to the Prime Minister, the previous Prime Minister. 16 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman.
Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Simple things that I can wrap my head around. I didn't know where he was going, but I began to understand when he stood up on his stool like a fool and started hollering at the man.
Hey, welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border, streaming all around the planet, and broadcasting live from Denmark, from Copenhagen. When I lived in Germany, they said Copenhagen.
Germans put it that way.
Uh-huh. Interesting. We're talking with Peter Morgenson. He is the chief editor of Politiken and political commentator, former advisor to the previous prime minister, what we would call a liberal, but in Europe, liberal means conservative in the United States, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. It's totally confusing to Americans, but I get it. And the question I asked you before we went to the break, to what extent was the worker uprising in 1921 that led to the social democracy here in Denmark? First of all, there are similar governments in seemingly all the Scandinavian countries. To what extent was it a regional thing? To what extent was it a European thing? How was it related or interrelated with the rest of the world? What was the gestalt?
Yeah, well, the reality is that it was a very much a regional phenomenon, the socialist uprising, you can say. Certainly, it was very much connected to the development of the communist regimes around Europe, which ended up in some countries, as you of course know, became real communist societies, or at least they tried to be. The Scandinavian version of that, which spun out of this international cooperation, came into this sort of center-left socialist type of version. That's what they wanted. They wanted the people to share the power. For a very long time, up until the 1950s, the largest leading socialist democratic party in Denmark actually wanted to have government power over the factories and shareholders type of things. They abandoned
that. That's closer to genuine communism.
Absolutely. In your view, that would be like that. But however, market economies were so persuasive that they went out of that thinking in the 1950s and have never ever returned to that, even though there were a lot of discussion during the 70s and so on. But so that was abandoned at the time, but it was on the paper, that type of way. But obviously we came from a totally different area. We came from the very right-wing type of things where people owned their own machines and all that kind of thing. So it never even got close to that, of course, but that's just what they wanted, this labor movement, so to speak, in the very old days.
That's interesting. By the way, if you have a question for Peter Morganson, you mind taking calls from some of our listeners?
Absolutely.
866-303-2270 is our toll-free number, and we'd be glad to pick up your calls. You worked with the Social Democratic Party.
Right.
This is the party that was in power. Why did the Social Democratic Party, the center-left party, lose its power to the Danish People's Party, did you say?
It's to the Liberal Party. Let me just briefly explain what the setup is around here. The Social Democratic Party has been running the show in this country for basically most of the years since 1921. But once in a while, we have a different majority where the right wing has governed the country, right, as they do today. There's been small pockets of time eras where they have been into power. So what the reason they lost at the last time was mainly...
The right wingers or you?
The right wing, the Social Democratic, right, the prime minister I worked for,
right,
he was Social Democratic. The reason he lost his power in 2001 until the current prime minister, which is right wing, is because of the immigration issue, basically.
Yeah.
As point number one, and reason number two, far below that, is a taxation policy discussions, mm-hmm, a freezing of the taxes in Denmark.
What is the average income tax rate in Denmark right now? And how progressive, how graduated is it?
Yeah, right. The reality is around on average, people pay about 52% income tax. On the margin, you pay 62%, 63%.
On the margin, meaning if you're a high-income person?
If you're a high-income, exactly. Yeah. Then you pay about 62%,
63%. And if you're a very low-income person, how much are you making?
If you're low-income, it's about... If you're very, very low, then it's about 45%, 50%.
And I have this theory that I think perhaps I'm seeing played out here in Denmark, that if an employer knows how much you're willing to work for, or you know, the marketplace defines that or whatever, and say it's $100,000, say it's $50,000 a year, just to pull a number out of the air,
right,
and somebody's making $100,000, they're paying a 50% tax, they're walking home with $50,000 at the end of the year. If the tax goes up by 20%, then you know, they're not willing to work for that anymore, so pay is going to go up. If tax goes down, pay is going to go down. We've seen a steady cut in taxes. When Reagan came in 30 years ago,
right,
he cut taxes from a top marginal rate of 70% down to 28%. And pay, since Reagan came into office, has been steadily declining in the United States. And I say, why? Because the employers know, hey, they'll work for less, right? We cut their taxes, we're going to cut their wages. So I would assume if you increase taxes, you'll increase wages. Does that make sense?
Well, that's the theory behind the Reagan's years. I agree with that. That's what he thought. But he also, the amount of tax he got in to finance the public sector in the U.S., they basically went bankrupt.
Where we are right now. Let's pick this up after this break. We're talking Peter Morganson, 866-303-2270.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
No R in there. I'm sorry. I was dropping it in. The chief editor of Politiken and political commentary and former political advisor of the previous prime minister. And you've been around the political block here for quite a while, Peter. We've got a bunch of callers with questions for you. Before we get to them, just in a nutshell, for that 50-some-odd percent income tax that people are paying here in Denmark, what are they getting?
Well, basically, in a nutshell, they're getting all types of public service in terms of making your life work, in terms of schools are free, hospitals.
Through college?
College are free. High school, of course, is free. All types of health care is free.
Including old age like hospice or retirement homes?
Hospice is free. There is some places you have to pay a bit for kindergarten, for example. Mm-hmm. But it's very expensive. You pay, I guess, about 25% of what it costs in real terms to have a kid in a kindergarten. You pay that yourself.
This is a preschool school.
This is before they get into school, and the public sector pays 75% of that. So, but basically you get the... All your needs financed through your taxes, and as you realize, the big discussion here is, of course, are the outcome of that to each individual satisfactory to what compared to what you pay in taxes.
In the United States, about half, I think 53% was the last number I saw, of all bankruptcies. I mean, people who are just absolutely devastated are the result of people becoming ill.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm assuming the percentage of people who experience bankruptcy as a result of medical problems in Denmark is...
It's zero.
Zero. Okay. Yeah. And an additional third of bankruptcies in the United States is a result of divorce. Usually women ending up without an income and can't get a job or can't get a good paying job. But they're still stuck with half the bills and very often the children. Is that a problem?
Well, it's obviously there's a lot of financial, you could call it, problems when people get divorced in Denmark too. But in Denmark, we have about 80% of the women are working. It's a very high factor in global terms also. So usually the woman is working too.
Yeah.
And obviously there are quite strict rules in terms of the father.
Child support payments.
Exactly, yeah. You have to do that. So.
Interesting. Let's take some phone calls here.
Sure.
Greg in Phoenix, Arizona. Greg, you're on with Peter Mogensen.
Good morning, Tom. Good morning, Mr. Mogensen, although I assume it's actually evening where you're at.
Yeah, it is, actually. It's 6:37 p.m.
Very good. Well, I'm in Phoenix, and I just want to first say, Tom, I'm an absolute addict of your show. It's always painful to have to tear myself away to work at 10 o'clock, so I listen to the first hour of my... Colin, this is going to be a particularly difficult episode to tear myself away from because I think it's fascinating. I want to thank Mr. Mogensen for taking the time to speak to us.
Sure, absolutely.
I'll try and make my questions very brief. As an educator, and basically I was in adult education, sort of was forced out in that I basically could not afford to work in that field and support myself in California because it's just... doesn't pay enough to be a teacher these days in America. I'm interested, and I'm sure, Tom, you'll get into a lot of this stuff during the week of comparing the educational system, the healthcare system, and I really enjoy hearing from Europeans because I think they have a certain credibility that we liberals in America don't because their system works in a lot of ways that ours doesn't. But I'd be interested in anything you can describe as far as how the education system works. And just as a footnote, I'm wondering if people in Denmark and Copenhagen actually – if presidential politics in America is something that people there actually talk about and are informed about, and I'd be fascinated to hear your responses to both those issues.
Thank you, Greg.
Sure. In terms of the educational system, as I said before, everything is actually free. You go from first to ninth grade or zero grade into ninth grade, and then you start for what you would call high school. Same system, actually.
Mm-hmm.
The qualification in terms of getting into universities in Denmark is it's only on your grades, really. It's not about money. It's about how well you do in your exams.
Right.
So that's the way you qualify yourself to get into that. We do have challenges as well. As you are describing the U.S. teacher environment, we have the same challenges in Denmark. It used to be a sort of an education to be a teacher, which was there was quite a lot of and very nice era around it. These days, the rest of the society over the three or four last decades has been very much educated in parallel. So a teacher's education today is not what it was compared to the rest of the society, and they sense that as well in their daily work.
Are teachers well paid?
No, they're not very well paid. We would say they're not very well paid in terms of if you compare to other people, but the reality is they don't work. They have very long vacations compared to the rest of the society.
Right.
They do not have that much work on the daily basis as in terms of hours. It's always a huge discussion going on in this country about how much a teacher really worked, but they say they work a lot and get paid less. The general...
Well, the teachers in the United States say the same thing, although it's very much true in the United States. They're expected to grade papers at home at night. They're expected to work over the weekends during the summer. They have to do continuing education at their own expense. They're not paid for it.
Let me give you this. A teacher, they have the same arguments in Denmark. They are getting paid a little bit more than a policeman and a nurse. They're getting paid more like...
So it's a middle class, civil servant. Salary.
Absolutely, yeah. It's on middle type of education.
Well, that's not terrible.
No, absolutely not. It's an okay salary, absolutely. And you can live, I mean, compared to California, you can certainly live for that salary in this country if you want to do that.
Okay. Let's pick up another call here. Becky in Dolliver, Iowa. Hey, Becky, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. This past school year, we had a student from Denmark that lived with us. His name was Morten, and we just really, really enjoyed him. And then in March, his whole family came over and visited us, and we kind of did the Western United States whirlwind tour. And, you know, just everything that I've learned about Denmark this past year and everything that I'm hearing now on your show, I'm just so fascinated with the culture and society, and I really wish that the United States was a little bit more like Denmark.
So Peter, suggestions or thank you, Becky. Peter Mogensen.
It's difficult.
You're the editor of the second largest newspaper in this country, and
political editor,
and you know, former advisor, number two guy to the prime minister. How does America become more like Denmark? Thoughts or suggestions? Ideas?
No. I mean, you know, it's a structural thing and a historical development, which is totally different between the two countries.
Yeah.
There are certainly pluses and minuses on both accounts. And I would say now the former caller here, he asked about, are we listening to what is happening in the presidential campaign? Absolutely, a lot. We're following this. Your debate on healthcare, we think, are very strange because we do have healthcare.
Right.
But obviously, your debate on taxation is very interesting here because we have a lot of taxation and a lot of people like that to be lowered. How do you balance that in terms of public sector versus we have a huge discussion on, well, we have healthcare for everybody, but on the peak achievements in terms of healthcare. The richest people in the U.S., they get better healthcare than any Dane does because we get very good healthcare, but the absolute best, obviously, we cannot compete with Sloan Kettering in terms of cancer and so on.
But isn't it true that the richest Danes can get that kind of healthcare too?
Well, the very, very richest Danes can do that. I would say also to compensate for that, at the latest, the government has made a bill that says if you cannot get the right treatment within the first month of your disease, you will be flown somewhere in the world of the expense of the government to be treated at some other private hospital somewhere else.
And this is the law now?
This is the law, yeah.
Wow.
And,
too shabby.
Yeah, so I think the countries, you know, they are very different, of course.
Yeah. Let's see, Mark in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Mark, on KPOJ, you're on with Peter Mogensen.
Hi, Warren Gollett. I am a...
What did he say?
He says, how are you doing?
I'm a grandson of Danish immigrants that came to America, and unfortunately they came over in 1930. But, anyway, fascinating show. Thank you, Maya Talk, for your commentary today. My question is about the problem with outside of the Danish citizens. What is the largest percentage of non-Danish immigrants that are in Denmark, and what is the process if someone wanted to apply for citizenship to Denmark? Can you speak to those two issues?
Thinking of moving, Mark?
Yeah.
Okay.
Very quickly, we have about, I think, 8% immigrants. And the largest part of that is Muslim background somewhere from different types of Muslim countries. We have also a lot of immigrants from Western European countries and the United States, of course.
Yeah.
But according to the Danish political discussion, we don't see them as immigrants in exactly the same way as we see the Muslims. That's the debate line right there.
So, much like in the United States, we've got commentators who are all hysterical immigrants who basically are brown-skinned people.
Right, exactly. You know, that's the same.
Particularly Mexicans, South Americans.
Sure.
And to some extent Africans. I mean, you know, discrimination. But not so much if somebody emigrated from the U.K., there would be very little outrage. So you have the same situation.
Exactly. And there are very tough rules in getting any kind of citizenship in Denmark, and goes also for the Western. We cannot differentiate between people according to our national laws, so everybody gets touched by the very tough laws.
Yeah, okay. We'll continue the conversation with Peter Mogensen in just a moment. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program.
You are listening to Tom Hartman.
Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here, broadcasting live from Denmark, from Copenhagen. Copenhagen, Denmark. And Peter Mogensen is with me. He is the political editor for the second largest newspaper in the country, right? And that is Politica. Where'd it go? I lost my list here.
Politiken.
There it is.
That's the name.
Yep. And a former political advisor to the previous Prime Minister, Poul Nyrup Rasmussen?
Poul Nyrup Rasmussen. Right.
Of the Social Democrats.
Very close. Yeah.
There we go. Okay. Well, we got a whole bunch of calls here for you. Craig in Berkeley, California. Hey, Craig, you're live with Peter.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi.
I was kind of curious about, the social structure there in America here, where prisons are bursting at the seams, and we have a lot of problems with the mentally ill, homelessness, school dropout rate, teen pregnancy. How is it in Denmark?
Excellent question.
Yeah, that's a good question. Thank you for that. I mean, obviously we have the some of what you said. We have the same issues around prisons, which is overloaded, basically. We have a lot of issues around the people who came in from other countries to live here, which has not been integrated to the right extent into the society, and they have a higher crime rate, so to speak, and there's a filling up the prisons to some extent, which is not very satisfactory. And I would say, except for the homeless thing, you know, we have had a very good time in Denmark in financial and economic terms for many years now, 1.5 decade actually. Mm-hmm. And I would say the homeless is more a mental problem for a lot of people rather than being actually poor. We don't have that type of, and they do get help from the society. Teen problems in terms of getting pregnant as teen. It's not that big an issue around in Denmark.
So you have good comprehensive sex education, and birth control is widely available?
It's widely available. Education, if it's good or not, I would say question mark. But it's at least not in the public debate. That's not a large issue, so to speak.
Right.
And we don't see it as a big issue around here. But
right.
The other points you mentioned, for sure, that's something we do struggle with.
Interesting. Let's see here. Hesham in Irvine, California. Hesham, you're on the air.
Yes, hi Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Great to be on your program.
Thank you.
I had a question for Mr. Mogensen regarding the difference between the two parties as far as the immigration laws are concerned. My understanding is that Denmark is quite racist. I mean, they discriminate against people based on their religion, national origin, color of skin. So I'm not sure where the difference lies between the two parties.
Hmm. Well, it's a good question. The reality is that I think you're right in terms of of we do have a wave of political discussion in Denmark, which we have had since the current government came into office in 2001, where skin color was actually the real issue below all the discussion around immigration.
This is what we're experiencing in the United States right now, too.
It is.
You know, oh my God, it's those brown people from Mexico. Exactly. Nobody's yelling about the English immigrants.
Right, exactly. And bottom line, that's what has scared people. There has been a very heavy campaign from the government and the extreme right party we have here, which has been communicating about the issues that came if too many people from a totally different culture came into the Danish society. That worry has been communicated very clearly. I would say today there are some differences in terms of how to integrate the people who will come in between the two blocks in the parliament, the right wing and the left. But in terms of how many should get in here, they're almost equal in their views. And basically they are that because a lot of the politicians have smelled that the public actually, they more or less bought into the discussion that has been around this since the current government came into power.
It's interesting that you say it's 50-50. That's fascinating. Mina is in St. Paul, Nebraska. Hey, Mina.
Hi. First of all, for Dan Stardy Till, my grandmother was born in the Silkenborg area, and my grandfather came from the Sedgwick-Holstein area when it was part of Denmark.
Okay.
We're hearing a lot of Danish here on here.
That's interesting.
We visited Denmark in 73 and 74, and what we noticed was all of the Danes rode the public transportation free. And at that time, it was very reasonable for those of us visiting because it cost us about 12 cents, and if we did our return trip within an hour, that was free. We were also, we registered and at the train depot, and we stayed in people's homes at a much less cost, where we really got the flavor of Denmark. Are those homes still available?
I would say that, not to my knowledge, the homes, but obviously, unfortunately, the thing about the almost free public transport is not here anymore either. We do pay a lot, and it is a big discussion issue in the Danish political society if you should lower the cost for public transport. But so on that issue, I have to disappoint you that the taxpayers' money is being used for public transport, but certainly not to a degree where the prices are lowest.
We have about a half a minute left. George in Fort Lauderdale, listening on WINS. A very quick question, George.
Yeah, good evening to both. Very quick, I'm just curious about how to do general sales taxes and property taxes in Denmark compared to the United States. And secondly, very quickly, do you think globalization is threatening your system in the sense that you might have young, talented people getting a first-rate education by the state and then move to other countries in Europe because they can pay less taxes? And also even
George, we're going to be totally out of time if we don't answer these two questions. Thanks for the...
Okay, very quickly on the tax issue. I don't know about the United States, but we do tax property this country. We don't tax when you sell your property.
Uh-huh.
And in terms of globalization, that is a big issue and discussion around here. If the taxes do take the incentives for people to come here, but basically with the immigration laws we have these days, there is not a huge incentives anyway. It's very hard to get here anyway. But obviously, we do struggle.
And you don't have an exodus. We're out of time. Peter Mogensen, thank you so much.
So, no problem.
Tom Hartman.
Exposing the con in conservative.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Uncommon sense from the radical middle.
This is Tom Hartman.
Indeed it is. I'm back broadcasting live from Copenhagen, Denmark. And, back in March, we went to Darfur. We went to the southern Sudan on the border of Darfur at Gok Machar, this refugee camp, a town of 8,000 people that had swelled to 45,000 human beings with one well, no electricity, no roads. We were in the worst place on earth, arguably. And so we decided, as a bookend to that, to come to what, in fact, we're going to, on Wednesday, we're going to have the author of the study on, suggesting who is on 60 Minutes and whatnot, suggesting Denmark is the best place on earth. And to find out, you know, what lessons do we have to learn as Americans? What can the world learn from Denmark? And, you know, what's the upside? What's the downside? What's going on? Carl Peterson is with me. He's an adjunct professor at the Copenhagen Business School, an associate professor of American history. He's with the Department of English, German, and Roman Languages. He's the author of numerous books, including published in Danish, including The Other USA, Renewal and Freedom in Future America, The Wrong War, The USA and the New World Order, and The United States of America in the 21st Century, and your first book, The Vulnerable Nation, The U.S. from 91 to 2001. Carl was born in the United States of Danish parents, and in 1972, at the age of 21, came to Denmark and has been living here ever since, right, and teaching at the university. Carl, welcome.
Thank you.
And it's your English is a little more American than most, it seems.
Well, I would hope so.
Because you grew up in the United States.
Right.
from a Danish point of view, and you also have been writing extensively now and teaching and commentarying or, you know, pontificating about American politics. From a Danish point of view, what's going on in the United States right now?
Ooh, wow. That's a pretty big question. I mean, one thing I think is remarkable about Denmark in the current election cycle, and actually it started back in 2000, is the intensity and interest there is in the American political process.
Mm-hmm.
There are, you know, regular programs, commentaries, and I give talks around the country. People are so interested in what's going on in the United States. But when you ask, the Danish take on the United States is interesting, because there's a lot of, how should I put it? I mean, it's not monolithic, but because there are some Danes, especially those with a conservative viewpoint, that support the Republican administration.
Well, your current prime minister has been
certainly.
Over to the... to the Bush White House. He's,
and he's had
George
multiple,
Bush came here.
He started out having breakfast at the White House, and he graduated to a visit at Crawford, Texas.
Yeah, he's good buddies with George.
Oh, yes, very good buddies, and they go mountain bike riding and so on and so forth. So there is an element of Danish society that thinks that the current administration is doing the right thing and also supports really the administration ideologically, which I think is interesting.
Yeah.
Also, given that Denmark is, for all intents and purposes, really a social democratic society. Having said that, then there's another view of the United States, which sometimes is nuanced, but sometimes intends to indulges in stereotypes about the United States and focuses on things in the United States that are different than they are here in Denmark. Usually the implication being very often that Denmark is simply a better society than the American society.
Well, isn't that kind of nationalism and xenophobia too strong a word for it? Tribalism might be the right word.
Sure.
Isn't that just natural in every society on earth?
Oh, I suppose. I know the Danish society and American society best.
Right.
And it's remarkable that you hear the same narratives about the United States. There's an enormous focus. For example, the execution that just took place in South Carolina a couple of days ago. That is almost front page news in Denmark. That gets a lot of
press. I doubt most Americans even know about it.
Exactly.
You're talking about the electric chair one?
Yes, the electric chair one. And I remember, you know, hearing about it on the Danish news and then going through the American media and finding out where it was placed in the New York Times, Washington Post.
Right. Page 16,
yeah.
Column 9.
Now, it has something to do with, of course, Denmark doesn't have the death penalty. You can't be in the European Union if you have the death penalty. So the United States is an outlier in that regard.
Right.
And it fits into a Danish conception of the U.S. as being sort of primitive and a little, it's the same with not only the death penalty, you get the same with issues like abortion, gun control, and so on. Because Danish society, these aren't issues here. Then there's a fascination, but also a sense that this society is better. Now, when you say that, you know, most societies think that way, you won't get Danes, and it's certainly not that much a part of political rhetoric here, talking about Denmark as the greatest nation on earth. The kind of rhetoric you get often in the United States.
Right, there's not that breast-beating, eye-cloudiest.
No, but there is an underlying sense that not only is Denmark one of the best, if not the best society on earth, there's also a sense for Danes that other people can't tell the Danes how to run things. So, for example...
That seems net normal, too.
Well, again, I think that there's been a lot of criticism of Denmark's immigration policies that come from, like, the European Council has criticized it in various reports, for example.
Right. To put this in context, though, if I got to interrupt you just a second.
Sure.
Denmark had fairly open immigration policies during the 80s and the 90s,
yeah.
is my understanding, and just in the last... 6-8 years, mm-hmm. you've dramatically tightened up your immigration policy.
Yes, it's become a real issue here.
Okay, so to put that in context.
Yeah, and the Danish People's Party, is the which is the anti-immigration party
right.
In Denmark, is the third largest party in the country, and they wield okay. enormous influence because they support the conservative government. And again, yes, you say that most countries may do that. Again, I know Denmark best, and there's this sort of automatic, what I often hear, also as an American living here, is criticism from Danes of my country, criticizing racism in my country, criticizing gun violence, criticizing the role of the religious right, and so on. If I then say something about Danish society, about anti-immigration policies, there's this automatic sort of defensive, well, you don't really understand Mm-hmm. Danish society enough.
Although your parents are Danish and you've lived here since 72.
It's become less so, but when I first came here, it was very pronounced. I just couldn't say, when I came here in the 70s, that was during the Vietnam War, there were race riots in the U.S., and I heard, you know, time and again about how my society was racist, how it was suppressing the Vietnamese and so on. And then if I pointed out something about Danish society, it was immediately this reaction, well, you can't talk about it because you don't. And at the time, now, one of the reasons for Danish interest in the U.S. is, I think, because so many Danes now go to the U.S. Travel is very cheap. Many students go to the U.S., and there's a fascination with U.S. popular culture. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't the case in the 70s, but still, because not that many people went to
the U.S. Well, I'm guessing there are probably millions of Americans of Danish ancestry as well.
Well, of the Scandinavian countries, Denmark sent the fewest to the United States. More immigrants came from Sweden, for example.
Yeah.
And Danish immigrants are concentrated mainly in Nebraska, Iowa, and Minnesota, not so much on either coast. Yeah.
But you're a keen observer of the American political scene from the Danish point of view. You're fluent in Danish, obviously.
Yes.
Grew up in speaking Danish, and you've written 4 books in Danish, largely about the United States.
Yes,
I find this fascinating. We're going to have to take a break in about 30 seconds, and we're talking with Carl Pedersen, spelled Pedersen. The very Scandinavian spelling.
Yeah, I've been spelling it all my life.
and when we come back, and we'll also take calls for Carl if you have questions. Our number 866-303-2270. When we come back, I'd like to get into that issue of how, not just Denmark, because Denmark is part of Scandinavia. Scandinavia is part of Europe. You know, broadly speaking, how does this end of the world view the war in Iraq? View the Bush administration? What are the thoughts here on Barack Obama versus John McCain? Or for that matter, you know, when Hillary Clinton was in the race, how is that splitting up Danish society, Scandinavian society, European society?
Mm-hmm.
And you're the real expert on these things. I'm really glad to have you with us. Carl Pedersen in the studio here. Tom Hartman broadcasting live from Copenhagen, Denmark.
This is Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Truth in Broadcasting.
Song. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Copenhagen, Denmark. Carl Peterson is with us, an adjunct professor at the Copenhagen Business School, the associate professor in American History at Copenhagen University. You got your PhD in American Studies. Is that
yes.
right? Do I have that right? Your wife is Danish. You have three kids. They all speak Danish and English.
Yes.
You were born of Danish parents in the United States, which automatically made you a U.S. citizen. Mm-hmm. And you came back to Denmark in 72. You have hung on to your U.S. citizenship.
Yes.
So you are a U.S. citizen here in Denmark.
Yeah.
I want to get into American politics with you, but just a real quick question. As a U.S. citizen who's living and working in Denmark, do you get all the bennies of this social welfare state? Do you get free health care? Do you get everything?
Everything.
Is it?
I also pay Danish taxes.
Right. Right. Okay.
Yeah.
So, do you think it's a good deal? Do you think it's a reasonable trade-off?
Yes, I do. Yeah. I think that it's a wonderful system, I must say. I've benefited from it. My kids have. I think it's a reasonable trade-off, but it's a trade-off because when I go back to the U.S. and I tell people I'm living in Denmark, and if I start talking to them about the system here, and they go, oh, this is wonderful, free medical care and free universities, and then all I have to do is tell them what I pay in taxes, and they go, I don't want to do it.
But don't Danes have a higher pre-tax wage than in those countries that have lower taxes? After you've paid your taxes, the amount of money that goes into your checking account at the end of every month is probably not that different from France, which has a slightly lower tax rate, or Hungary, which has a dramatically lower tax rate.
Right, but also, I mean, Denmark, goods are very expensive here. There's value-added tax of 25% on goods.
Right.
But then, again, the minimum wage is very high here.
What is the minimum wage?
I think at the moment it's it's $5.15 in the U.S. at the moment, and here it's I just have to convert it into
in kroners.
Yeah, into it's I'm trying to think of the exact.
Well, we'll come back.
It's about $15
U.S. dollars.
Yeah.
Per hour.
Yeah.
Is the minimum wage.
Yeah.
Yeah, not too shabby.
No.
So, you know, if I'm making $15 an hour and I'm paying 50% taxes and I never have to worry about health care and I can get a PhD for free.
Yeah.
In fact, you pay students to go to college.
You pay every university student gets a monthly stipend to study, yes.
and my kids in college right now are spending, you know, $150 for a single textbook.
Right, right. I mean, I know my sister, you know, she was saving up for her kids to go to college when they were born, and that's
right.
just not a concern here.
Yeah. Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, John McCain, George Bush, from all the Danes that I've talked to in the 24 hours I've been here, and Leah, who's been doing a great job, our producer, working with us, and we'll hear from her as the week goes on. These are major topics of discussion in Denmark, the American political process.
Mm-hmm.
A, why?
Mm-hmm.
And B, what's the consensus?
Well, why, I think there's two things at work. One is that Danes are surrounded by American culture. They see American films, they listen to American music, they wear American clothing. So in a sense, the United States feels close to them.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there's the other aspect. The United States is still, for all intents and purposes, the sole remaining superpower. And you hear often Danes say we should be able to vote in the American elections because the American elections have a direct effect on us. So that's part of it. And then add to that that the American political process is simply makes for good television.
Yeah. It really does.
I mean, Danish elections are frankly a little boring.
Rather boring.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and you have proportional representation.
Yes.
So you've got many different political parties. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the kind of hard right anti-immigration party, although it's not the party in power, is the party that has tipped the scales of the balance of power to that of the more moderate right-wing party that is in power, is it?
Yes,
is that right?
Exactly. I mean, they support, if they weren't there to support the conservative liberal government, as it's called, right, then the government couldn't function.
So do most Danes support Barack Obama or John McCain?
Well, it's interesting. At the beginning of the political process, you saw also many commentators and people supporting Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm. Because you know the Clintons.
You know the Clintons, and Bill Clinton comes here regularly, and
oh,
he's
really?
And he's treated like a rock star,
yeah.
You know. And he's been to many towns in Denmark, and uh-huh. he breezes through. Now, when he, you know, just published his tax returns in the U.S. that uh-huh. he had made $109 million
right.
after he was president, in part because of these speaking tours. So he goes all over the place.
Uh-huh.
So he's been here very often, and he gets good press. Again, there's a sense that Danes, many Danes, they think a Democrat is more familiar to them than
right.
a Republican like George Bush.
Right, because it's closer to the Danish social structure anyway. We'll continue this conversation right after the break. We're talking with Carl Peterson, Associate Professor of American History at Copenhagen University, and a unique point of view, the author of 4 books on the United States. It's 27 minutes past the hour. We'll take your calls after the break as well. Carl.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
My friends, 34 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program on Air America Radio. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartman.com for our live chat room. I've got to hop into that. We've been having some computer problems, isn't quite the right word here. So it may be the next break before I can get in there. And, of course, airamerica.com and hartmanradio, I think, .com gets you there. We're talking with Carl Peterson. He's here live in the studio with us in Copenhagen. As the Danes would say.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, it's Copenhagen.
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 Yeah, yeah. You really have to swallow.
Yeah.
There
you go. Okay. So, Carl, and we've got a bunch of callers. I want to pick them up. But just very quickly, your thoughts on the Danish thoughts, and for that matter on the Scandinavian and European thoughts, on Bush. We never did get to Barack Obama and McCain.
Well, you know, again, Danes tend to see Bush as somebody that's very foreign to them in attitude, in the,
sort of in the Americans.
Well, that's the thing. And I mean, you know, I remember Michael Lind of the New America Foundation. He has this thing about, you know, you have the middle part of the, and then he talks about your America, E-U-R America, on
right.
both coasts.
Right.
And that's supposed to be, you know, more relating to how Europeans think and so on.
Well,
and
I'll tell you, I grew up in the Midwest. There's a lot of people there that think Bush is crazy.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, you know, it's a caricature in a way.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to hear how, like during the campaign, people like Rudy Giuliani and Mitt Romney had this great line when he left the campaign where he talked about, if the United States doesn't watch it, we'll become the France of the 21st century. And I thought, my goodness, you know, he's saying that's about the worst thing that could happen to the United States.
So right? We'd have free health care, free public education,
exactly.
Good public transportation.
Yeah, yeah.
Less money spent on
But, of course, he didn't, you know, he wasn't thinking of that.
No, I think he was just thinking that he'd speak French.
As far as, the Danes are now, as I say, many were supporters of Hillary Clinton, but now more and more, now that Obama's become the presumptive nominee, you hear more and more here Danes thinking, well, this is an exciting candidacy.
Now, I've heard that, you know, in fact, we had a caller from the United States who was saying, and our last guest to some extent agreed with him, that there is essentially a racist movement in Denmark, much like there is in the United States, kind of the Lou Dobbs end of the spectrum. You know, the, oh, my God, the brown people are coming.
Yeah, yeah,
and,
definitely.
And so how does that affect the Danish perception of a presidential candidate whose father was from Africa and you know, who is African-American?
Well, I often get asked the question, is America ready for a black president? You know, the implication being that how can it be because the U.S. is a racist society and so on and so forth. And
so America is perceived as a racist society by Danes?
By some, yeah, certainly. And I mean, you know, I try to also talk about how the United States has also, I'm saying, like, the racial issue in the United States is both getting better and worse at the same time. In other words, you can see improvements since the civil rights era. Nobody can deny that. But then there are incidents like in Jena and so on and so forth that unfortunately take the United States back.
Although it may be that 10 years ago that exact same thing would have happened and it simply never would have made the press.
Well, exactly. And also the guys that murdered James Byrd in Texas, they were promptly arrested and put on trial and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and we're still looking for the killers so many of the killers during the 60s and 70s.
Yes, exactly, those retrials that are going on and so on. The Danes that support a Barack Obama would highly likely not be supporters of the anti-immigrant party here in Denmark.
Okay.
McCain gets some support, interestingly enough, from conservative editors in Denmark and also conservative politicians. And they focus mainly, when they talk about McCain, they talk about free trade.
Oh,
they say he's a free trader.
Right.
Where Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, for that matter, are protectionists.
Right.
So they just divide, you know, the two.
Is Denmark a relatively protectionistic country, or has it seamlessly integrated with the EU and for that matter, the WTO?
Well, I wouldn't say seamlessly, but certainly Denmark, vis-a-vis the United States, thinks that a protectionist president would be a bad thing for Denmark.
Oh, interesting. Because it would keep Danish products out of the United States.
Yeah, basically. Okay. That's what they're thinking.
That makes sense.
Primarily, yeah.
That makes sense. Jim in Pittsburgh, you're on the air with Carl Peterson here in Denmark.
Yeah, thanks. I was in the Army station in Germany, and I went to Copenhagen on leave, and I loved the Danes. But when I talked to a guy who was half American, half Danish like yourself, and this was in 1963, so it's been a while, but we talked about the medicine and the Medicare situation. And he said, if you had appendicitis attacks, you get on a waiting list, it might be there for 5 years. Now, the only way you get your appendix out is if it bursts and when you went into an emergency. So, number one, is that still the case? Or, like the previous guy said, you get flown out or something. But, you know, if you weren't, it wasn't an emergency situation. So you got on a list, and it was excruciating, he said, for some people to wait so long.
Well, there are waiting lists in Denmark. This is, of course, if you look at it from an American perspective, this is what the Republicans always criticize with what they call socialized medicine. They say that, you know, you get on these waiting lists, whereas in the U.S. you can be treated immediately. But having said that, there are waiting lists, but nobody is literally dying because they're on these lists, and the government does what it can to shorten the list, number one, and also see to it in some cases that patients are sent to Germany or Sweden for care.
For the more exotic things.
Yeah.
So Interesting. So, by and large, Danes are happy with their healthcare system. Is that a good generalization?
I think they are. I think they are. But, I mean, there's a caveat here because, you know, in Europe, the French system is widely regarded as being the best, better than the British NHS and better than the Danish system. But the Danes have sort of grown up with the idea that their system is the best. But now more and more, because there's been reports to that effect, that they can see that, that the French, there have been programs on in Denmark, sure, talking about how the French do more with less money. For
is this a single payer healthcare system here, or is it socialized? Does the government own the clinics and employ the doctors, or are they private? So it's a socialized.
But there are private hospitals in Denmark as well. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. That are outside the government insurance program.
Well, they are and they aren't. Some of them have agreements with certain districts in Denmark that they can send their patients to private hospitals if there's an overflow.
Interesting. Baji in New Mexico, you're on the air and listening on KTRC. You're on the air with Carl Peterson. Baji?
Oh, hi.
Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I appreciate your show. I spent a year in Denmark in 65, 66 and really enjoyed it and learned a lot. So it's great to hear this show on Denmark. I'm calling in reference to early childhood education, and I think both in Denmark and the United States, and I think it is such an important area of investment that the investment that we make when children are young not only helps the society, but it helps every single individual who gets off to a great start that comes through high-quality early childhood education. And I just suggest using the term early childhood education instead of preschool because it isn't anything that really should have a prefix of pre.
No, I get it. Baji, is there a question in there?
Well, I'm curious what how early childhood education is funded in Denmark and the importance that it has there in contributing to a society that works.
Thank you. Carl, thoughts on that?
Well, early childhood education, to use your term, is funded by the government or subsidized by the government.
This would be for children, children under 5 or 6 years old.
Yeah. I mean, there's 1 year of maternity leave, and after that...
Paid maternity leave?
Yes, for mothers. And then a half... year for paternity leave.
Really?
Yeah.
And at the same time?
They can decide when to take it. Some mothers decide to go just before they give birth on their maternity leave and so on. And then after the year, then there is daycare for children from years, they call it years 0 to 3. Mm-hmm. And then you go into another level.
And that's paid for by the state?
It's subsidized by the state. You have to pay something.
Oh, that's the one that's 75% subsidized.
Yeah, and then from 3 to 6, you go into another daycare level. And this is all preschool or early childhood.
That's the early childhood education.
Yes, exactly.
That's fascinating. We have to take a break here in just about 30 seconds. So, you know, rather than picking up another call, we'll get back to those on the other side of the break. But Carl... This whole thing in the Middle East right now, the United States vis-a-vis Iran, what's the European perspective on this? Are the Europeans freaked out?
Well, I think in the sense that they're freaked out at the thought that the United States, but this was talked about, Richard Perle talked about this way back in 2003, saying to Iran, you're next.
Right.
And yet the kind of aggressive saber rattling that you hear, this is something that upsets Europeans.
Yeah. It's upsetting a lot of Americans, too.
Exactly, and as it should.
45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, live from Copenhagen, from Copenhagen. Copenhagen.
Yeah, you'll get it.
I'll get it eventually. Yeah. There you go. Denmark. Stick around.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
No!
something to bless or to blame.
Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you live from Copenhagen, Denmark. We're talking with Carl Peterson. He's in the studio with us, the Associate Professor of American History at Copenhagen University. Grew up in the United States, living in Denmark since 1972, married to a Dane, the father of three Danish kids, and the author of numerous books on the United States written in you actually wrote these in Danish.
Yeah.
Yeah, you didn't translate them.
Yep.
Okay, let's pick up some phone calls here. 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Jim in Port Orford, Oregon. You're on with Carl Peterson.
Hi, folks. I'm really honored to speak with both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I have two areas of questions. One is food, the other is guns. The low man on a totem pole in Denmark, what's the percentage of his after-tax income that's spent on food for a good balanced diet?
Any sense of that?
First, the gun question was...
Okay. Yeah, what was the gun question?
The gun question was, in the U.S., we have 15,000-plus suicides every year and 11,000-plus homicides by guns. What are the facts and figures in Denmark?
I don't have the statistics for suicides or homicides in Denmark, but Denmark has a fairly high suicide rate, but people commit suicide in other ways here.
That's actually fairly typical of the northern Scandinavian countries, and there's a lot of speculation that it may have to do with
the long winters,
seasonal affective disorder.
Yeah, exactly. So the suicide rate is rather high in Denmark. Also curious for the country that's supposed to be the happiest in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the homicide rate, though, is very low. Again, I don't have the exact figures, but it's very, very low.
Right. And is food, I mean, you know, in the United States, I frankly don't know the percentage, and, you know, we're not statisticians, but,
no.
I mean, there are many places in the world. Recently, I was in Darfur. I mean, you know, there are places in the world where people spend more than half their time or more than half their money just getting food.
Right.
Is the cost of food a big problem here?
It's a big problem for some people, but for, I would say, the majority of Danes, it isn't.
Is there a poverty problem in Denmark?
There is.
Even with a $15 minimum wage?
Yeah, but it's a different kind of poverty than what you see in the United States. And the government does try to, you know, support the homeless in Denmark. And some people fall below the poverty line and have difficulty because rents are very high in Denmark. So they have difficulty paying rent, right, and so on and so forth. And Danes are always out for a bargain. There's a lot of the major supermarkets that also sell products very cheaply, and Danes like to get in on those sales. But for the most part, it's not a huge problem here.
Yeah, interesting. Eddie in Dallas, Texas, you're on with Carl Peterson.
How are y'all?
Good.
Fine.
Good to speak with y'all. I wanted to go and talk about the health care. Everybody, you know, says how wonderful it is in Canada and in Copenhagen that y'all don't have to pay anything, but you have long waits. I think Americans don't want to admit it, but we have long waits here too. We have to have our insurance, and then whenever I got to the hospital, I had to wait in line 16 hours.
Hmm.
So we have long lines here too.
Okay. Thoughts? You've experienced both systems here, Carl.
Yeah.
Which would you prefer?
Well, you know, in many things regarding Denmark and the United States, I say to my family and friends, I always end up in the middle of the Atlantic. There's some things, for example, preventive medicine, I think, in some ways works better in the United States. There's more a sense of trying to prevent certain diseases, you know, right, colon cancer, prostate right, cancer, and that kind of thing, whereas in Denmark it's more reactive, and you can argue it's that way because healthcare is so expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But I still think, and encouraged by the fact that all the major Democratic candidates support some form of universal health care, even though Dennis Kucinich was the only one that supported a single-payer
right.
system. But otherwise, they're supporting a system that will ensure all Americans. And I think it's high time it happened. And in that sense, you know, I can feel living in a country where it simply isn't a huge problem like right. it is in the United States is a good thing.
Yep. Okay. Eric in Monticello, Iowa. You're on with Carl Peterson.
Hi, I'm calling from Iowa, but I actually teach American Studies at the University of Wyoming. And in the nature of...
Oh, it's
of,
Eric, isn't it?
Yeah, Carl.
I recognize your voice.
In the nature of full disclosure, I should say that Carl and I have exchanged houses and jobs and... And so I know Carl quite well, and we've had lots of
What are the odds of this? This is incredible.
He's all over the place.
I show up yeah. in Denmark, and yeah. a friend
Well, he shows up in Denmark a lot, too, by
yeah,
the way.
Yeah, like a bad check. I just
exactly.
back to Carl's house.
Yeah.
And I should say that today is my 60th birthday, so I'm glad to be on the air during that.
Oh, yeah, happy birthday.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you about the middle of the Atlantic stuff, Carl. We've had lots of conversations about this, and there's a limit to time. And
yeah, we have about 40 seconds.
Yeah, but if you could transport something from Denmark to the U.S., and I know there are a lot of caveats about taxation and attitudes toward government, but what of the Danish social welfare system would you take to the U.S. first?
Oh, my goodness, what a question. I'll get back to you on this at some point. Well, I would say offhand, because the healthcare system isn't perfect, I'd say perhaps the educational, funding of universities or maternity leave or vacations.
Vacations?
It's a tough call. Yeah, because all Danes get 5 weeks paid vacation.
All Danes? You work
yeah.
at Burger King, you get 5 weeks paid
yeah,
vacation?
Yeah.
Well, Eric, yeah, thanks
Carl.
A lot for the call.
See ya.
5 weeks paid vacation. Not too shabby. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, and therefore business doesn't work, right? Carl Peterson, Pedersen, and Carl, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Associate Professor of American History at Copenhagen University. Stick around. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman. Listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
The True People's Radio.
This is Tom Hartman.
And it's 2006 here in Copenhagen, Denmark. It's just what? 8:06? Yeah, 8:06 in the evening. Holy cow. Welcome back to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman broadcasting live from Copenhagen, Denmark. Paul Alexander on the line with us, a former reporter for Time Magazine. He's written for Rolling Stone, The New York Times Magazine, The Nation, New York, The Village Voice, The Guardian, and the author of Man of the People, The Life of John McCain, as well as Machiavelli's Shadow, a new book about, well, let's see, Machiavelli. Who would that be? Hey, Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. How's Denmark?
It's kind of gray and windy, but other than that, very nice.
All right, anybody made a joke yet about something rotten being over there?
No, you're the first.
Am I the first?
You're the first.
Well, leave it to me to go for the old cliches. Huh?
There you go. But it's amazing. You know, we look out our hotel window, and there are the windmills in the harbor just chugging away. I mean, all that electricity just blowing right across the top of the country. Anyhow, you're Machiavelli's Shadow, of course, Karl Rove.
Right.
This is a fascinating topic. I one of the things that frankly horrified me about your book or in your book about Karl Rove was that even before George Bush apparently knew anything was going on with people, as literally as people were drowning, as 1,000 people were dying in New Orleans, and Karl Rove was out on the West Coast doing a fundraiser and a stunt and then going over to cut a birthday cake with John McCain. As that was happening, Karl Rove had already figured out and was already putting into place a plan to use Katrina to unseat, politically unseat, Catherine Blanco, the Democratic governor of Louisiana, and blame it on Louisiana Democrats.
That's absolutely right.
Tell us how this worked.
Well, the Bush administration had not fully understood the magnitude of the catastrophe that was about to happen with Katrina. They had thought it would be a standard sort of 2 or 3, 4 day news story, and you know, within a week we wouldn't be talking about the storm anymore. And you, right. And if you think about it, that's the way most storms are. You know, we watch them, they hit. You know, they're in the news cycle for a while, and then that's the end of the story.
Right.
But if you're from the Gulf Coast, and I'm from Alabama, and had relatives who lived in Mobile, when you see a 5 hovering out over the Gulf, as long as that 5 was hovering there, you knew there was going to be problems.
Right.
So Governor Blanco had declared a state of emergency on the Friday before the storm hit on Monday. But the Bush administration didn't get it. Bush was on vacation at his ranch in Crawford. He maintained his normal schedule. On Monday, as the storm was hitting, he went to Arizona, gave a state of the course speech about Iraq. On Tuesday, as at that point, you know, New Orleans was underwater because the levees had broken.
It was underwater, and people were already dead.
And people were
dead
on their roof. People were drowning in their attics. They were on their roofs begging for assistance. They were, you know, we all remember the pictures of them floating in the waters and on boats and everything else. He goes to California to give a state of the course speech in California on the USS Ronald Reagan. And it wasn't until late in the day on Tuesday that Roe figured out the enormous political damage that had been done in those 48 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So he came up with this cockamamie scheme that he was going to blame everything on Governor Blanco, the only Democratic governor down there he could blame it on. Alabama and Mississippi both had Republican governors. And so they, you know, he's
and Ray Nagin went along with this because he had actually been
like
a contributor.
Emailing Ray Nagin, who had hated Blanco so much that he had supported her opponent the last time around.
Well,
so,
not only that, he gave a couple thousand,
and he gave money to Bush. I mean,
right.
His nickname in New Orleans was Ray Reagan.
Right.
So Rove knew that he was sympathetic to the Republicans. So they're emailing, you know, back and forth, and they set up this thing where they're going to blame Blanco for everything. And so for part of that was. You know, they wanted her to turn over her troops, the National Guard troops, to the federal government, and which would essentially make the state of Louisiana a federal territory at that point. And so she refused to do it. And so there was a standoff that took place Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. The president finally goes down. They're still trying to strong arm her into signing onto this scheme. She still refuses to do it. And finally on Saturday, he relents and, you know, gives up on trying to get her to sign off on this document that he wanted her to sign and agrees to finally send in some federal assistance. But for Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, as people were drowning in New Orleans.
Enough time for a person to die of thirst if they don't have
access. Absolutely. And, you know, there was no assistance. You know, we look back now. The Superdome and the Convention Center were basically cleared out by federal, but not by federal, with federal assistance, but by state National Guardsmen.
Right.
What had happened was the 49 other states had sent their guardsmen down to work with Blanco and her guardsmen, and those are the people who actually evacuated everybody. By the time the federal troops arrived, those two venues were essentially empty.
Amazing. Amazing. So here we have, I mean, you know, the bigger picture here is how Karl Rove basically has turned everything he touched, and he could touch a lot as the senior political advisor to the president. He turned everything he could touch into a political vehicle.
Everything.
We've been through this with Don Siegelman, has been on this program about every other week for the last couple of months.
Right. I have a whole chapter about that in my book and Rove's involvement in the Siegelman affair.
Yeah. And you know, just another example of politicizing the Justice Department. It's at what point does this cease to become, you know, Lee Atwater campaign stuff? I mean, there are, you know, everybody likes to talk about going back to Tippi Canoe and Tyler too. That the, you know, dirty politics, and you know, it's just politics. You know, it's a, you know, John Adams was paying newspaper editors to write about Sally Hemings. You know, and that was in 1799.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is that what we have here is the actual corruption of the institutions of governance.
Absolutely, and that's new.
Yeah, well, it seems like it started with Nixon, didn't it?
Well, sure it did. Yeah, and there were definitely political operatives in the Nixon White House. But, you know, you bring up Atwater. Atwater did not follow George H.W. Bush into the White House after he got him elected in 88.
Hmm.
This is the first time that we've had the chief political strategist of a campaign come in and play an equally important role, if not more important role, in the actual administration. And eventually, you know, he even holds a policy position in the White House. Rove does eventually.
Right.
And he handles that so badly, they finally take it away from him. But this is the first time that we've had a political consultant this involved in the actual the running of an administration. And so by definition, this has been the most politicized administration we've ever had. And so their emphasis stops being on governing, you know, like how to help those poor people down in New Orleans during that week. And, okay, how do we protect the president's political viability? Because we can't have him damaged by this. So we have to find some scheme to blame it on somebody else. And then we have to put together a PR spin machine campaign to go out and, you know, present that to the public. That's what Rove was doing instead of making sure federal assistance got down there.
We're talking to Paul Alexander. He's the author of Machiavelli's Shadow. He's in the United States, by the way. All my guests up to this point have been folks from Denmark sitting here in the studio with me. Paul, we just have a minute or two left here. And what can we do to undo this? I mean, it seems like what we're seeing right now with this telco immunity bill, for example, is just another example of the politicization of public policy. How do we back out of this corner
I think we need to finish exposing. You know, McClellan has started the dialogue about exactly what the Bush administration was up to. I think we need to finish exposing what actually went on during the Bush administration. And I think the key development that could happen right now is if the House Judiciary Committee forces Karl Rove actually to appear on the Hill under oath in front of TV cameras and in front of the House Judiciary Committee and testify about anything they want to ask him about.
Right.
And I think that we could get to the bottom of the U.S. attorney scandal, the House Judiciary Committee, the Katrina scandal.
It's not going to happen, Paul. It's not going to happen. because I mean, they've already subpoenaed Harriet Myers and Josh Bolton, and they've simply said, no, we're not going to show up.
Right.
You know,
last week they trotted out Linda Sanchez, congressman from Los Angeles, to say that if the subpoena expires and Rove doesn't appear, they're going to hold him in contempt of Congress.
Right. And then if they don't use inherent contempt, that simply means it goes to court and sometime next year it gets resolved. So,
better late than never.
We'll see how it plays out. Paul, you've written a brilliant book, Machiavelli's Shadow. I recommend everybody check it out. Paul, thanks for dropping
by. Thank you.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman, 866-303-2270. Your call's up next.
Tom Hartman.
Taking back the mainstream media.
3 hours a day, 5 days a week.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
On who you elect, actually. 21 minutes past the hour. Welcome back, my friends. The Tom Hartman Program, brought to you, by the way, in part by the Teamsters, fighting to stop the unfair trade deal with Colombia. Find out more at teamster.org. We'd like to say a very heartfelt goodbye to George Carlin. George Carlin has animated, with his humor and with his insight, much of my life, and just an extraordinary voice for all of us. I mean, George Carlin said the things that couldn't be said, and he did it throughout his life. And so, good luck and Godspeed, George. And we're sorry to have you no longer with us. Our phone number, 866-303-2270, tomhartman.com and airamerica.com. And by the way, the moveon.org is saying to Barack Obama, you know, back about 6-8 months ago, maybe a year ago, you said that if this FISA bill ever came before the Senate with immunity for the telco companies, you were going to filibuster it. And we would like you to keep your word. And you can go over to moveon.org and sign the petition. And you can, and they've got the phone number for Senator Obama's office. And you can just let them know, hey, you know, you said you'd filibuster this thing. Here's our chance to find out. Are you good for your word? Audrey in Pasadena, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Audrey, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I was listening while you had some of your guests there in Denmark. And if you don't now, I won't pose this as a question. I'll probably make it more as a comment. But I used to live in Copenhagen for about 4 years working there. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you guys really got into that Yenta law. Did you talk about that earlier in the show or not? But I was going to discuss that in terms of the business environment. You know, the Yenta law says that no one's really much better than the other person, sort of that mentality they have. And
I don't know what you're talking about, Audrey. I know it's largely an egalitarian society. The idea of somebody being incredibly rich and somebody being incredibly poor is considered kind of an obscenity in some ways here.
Exactly.
Is that what you're talking about? That's actually written into law?
No, it's not a written law, but it's something that they call a Yenta law. It's like a custom law where you just don't look down on other people. Everybody's about the same. And I was going to discuss it in terms of the business environment, that it's not so hierarchical in how things are done there. When you have a boss or a supervisor, it was my experience that they're more like a guidance person or a counselor and not the way it is here in the U.S. And I was going to discuss that with Peterson and one of your guests. But but my also experience as a side note to that is being a Black American there, that in my work environment there, I felt much more again, equal or heard or respected in some of my views and opinions than I have sitting on exec councils of different companies here in the U.S. So that was my observation there, and I just wanted to point that out as well because they were talking about some of the other racial issues and how they feel about those things there.
That's very interesting. Audrey, thank you for sharing that with us.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it, and thank you for the call. We will be having guests every day, Monday through Thursday. On Friday, of course, Bernie Sanders will be with us, and it'll be Anything Goes Friday, although I'll be live here in Copenhagen. But Monday through Thursday, in fact, on Wednesday, we're going to have the editor of the newspaper that published the notorious Danish cartoons. He's going to be, as you might expect, defending his decisions. There's still quite a debate about that going on here in Denmark. And we've got quite a collection of fascinating Danes who are going to be on to talk about various aspects of Danish life, Scandinavian life, European life, and the European worldview of America. So I don't represent myself as an expert on this, but we've got a bunch of them coming up, so stick around. Donna in Seattle. Hey, Donna, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Thanks always for a thoughtful program. I'd like to just make a generic comment, and this is basically applies in all areas, but especially in reference to the conversation on the Denmark system.
Mm-hmm.
I feel we need to get rid of the idea that my country or system is the best. And this applies to all countries for two reasons, I think. It shuts us off from listening to something that may be beneficial with improving our own system, because I heard both good and bad in each system.
Sure.
And then also, down the road, there will always be something better that makes what we call our best now past tense. Right. If we're not open to new ideas in the long run, it just impedes our own progress.
No, I agree with you. And I think most countries, most citizens of most countries are willing to, including Americans and including Danes, are willing to look around. Well, in fact, you heard Carl talking about how there were a couple of specials on TV here about how the French healthcare system is better than the Danish. Now it's turned into a whole debate in Denmark about maybe we should do more like the French are doing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that aspect of we are the best, that is the non-toxic form. I think there's a toxic form and a non-toxic form. The toxic form was the Hitler form, right? We're the best, and therefore we'll kill everybody else. The we're the best, I think that that's simply part of human nature. I think that there's a tribal instinct to all of us, or a family instinct. It starts at the level of family. And there's a healthy dimension to that, and it can become very unhealthy, particularly when you get somebody like George Bush who tries to milk it for political purposes.
Yeah.
That's when we need to be wary. So I think for us to say that we can push that out of human nature, that ain't going to happen. Instead, we just need to be aware of it and notice when it's a healthy thing. You know, yes, this is our society. Let's care for everybody in our society. And also notice when it becomes unhealthy, when people say, oh, and that's their society, who gives a damn about them, that kind of thing. That's not healthy. Donna, thank you for the call. I'll wrap it up.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Copenhagen? All right. Oh, my. 866-303-2270. The chief strategist, Charlie Black, tells Barron Magazine, this is totally strange. Fortune Magazine. Totally strange. That Benazir Bhutto's death, quote, helped us, end quote. By us, he's speaking to the Republicans and the McCain campaign. And asked if another terrorist attack on U.S. soil would help McCain as well, Black told Fortune that it, quote, would indeed be a big advantage to him, end quote. In fact, the way Fortune put it, Black concedes with startling candor after we raise the issue, another terrorist attack on U.S. soil certainly would be a big advantage to John McCain. Man, at what point do you say, you guys shouldn't even be in politics? I mean, you guys just plain old flat out shouldn't be in politics. Robert in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Hey, Robert, welcome to the show.
How are you?
Just fine. I'm having a fine time here.
I was blown away this morning when I heard Carlin had passed away. And just to give you a fast story, I'm calling from Toronto, and there's a venue here called the O'Keefe Center, which used to be owned by a beer company. And 2,000 seats packed, 1970. I'm 11 years old. Spent $2 to get the standing room only. Had intermission, went down to the right inside the aisle and just sat there and listened to this guy. And I had the album AM/FM, but, you know, to see him when you're 11 years old. And it was after the show, he went to the backstage area and he came out and I said to him, would you sing Jenny? And in front of about a half a dozen people, he did it to this 11-year-old kid. He couldn't have been nicer. Yeah. And it was just this morning when I heard that, I sat there at the end of my bed for about a half hour just thinking how sad it was. He was so great at what he did.
Yeah.
And you mentioned it this morning, just about a minute ago on the air. I just wanted to, gee, he was just, you know, to an 11-year-old kid, he was just fantastic.
That's a wonderful eulogy.
Yeah.
Robert, thank you very much for sharing.
Thank you.
George Carlin, I mean, it's sad that he died. It's sad mostly for those of us he left behind, because he was an extraordinary talent and an extraordinary human being from all reports. Kristen. Is it? No, it's Kirsten.
Kirsten.
Hey, Kirsten. What's up?
Good evening to you, Tom. Thanks. Was very interested in knowing if you were able to glean any sense of what Carl's feelings are on the erosion of our Constitution by this administration.
You know, I didn't raise the topic with him. Pretty much, I'd say probably 95% of all the conversation we had was on the air. And he came in and we did the show and then he left. But those are topics I'm sure other Danes will bring up as we go along through the week. Danish guests on. And as we continue. And Leah, any thoughts on the evisceration of the U.S. Constitution here? Is this something that's a hot topic in Denmark? Oh, okay. We'll come back to it. We'll come back.
Okay. Thank you so much, Tom.
Thank you. I appreciate it. We've got to get a pair of headphones for Leah. Maybe she could wear those and Louise can wear these. Michael in Anchorage, Alaska. Hey, Michael.
Hey, Tom. I love your show. I just have to comment on something. The Karl Rove book, the Machiavellian book that the author was speaking
right.
about, I saw it on the bookshelves yesterday going through my local store. And, you know, you look at the current affairs books. In that section, there's books upon books and books upon books of documentation of one crime after another that this Bush administration. So my question is, why do we treat them really like legitimate politicians? They're criminals. Why can't we arrest them? Why can't Congress go out and enforce a subpoena? My God, we grew up in a time when the Congress brought in all the mob people in the 50s and the 60s. Mm. We had the Irwin Commission going after Nixon. It was high drama and a great celebration of our constitutional rights to do something about these people.
Yeah, I think the RICO laws actually should be used against the Republican Party right now because they are acting like a racketeering and organized crime organization.
Not only that, I mean, look at what happened in the murders. I mean, Bugliosi's got a book out now. I applaud him. But what about the Congress having the gumption to stand up and say these people are criminals? We can't treat them like legitimate politicians anymore if they don't even bother coming to our Congress for subpoenas.
Yep. And this is where one would hope that John Conyers will consider the use of inherent contempt. One member of the House Judiciary Committee has been pushing for that, and you know, unfortunately, that's it. I mean, you know, I think that we need to be letting our elected representatives know that we're over it.
Well, I think also we have to start reframing it, as you so often say, as criminal behavior that has killed human beings, murdered people. I can't say that strongly enough. I'm a Vietnam veteran. What he has done to the military and the destruction of our own defense forces and our position in the country, in the world today, is nothing less than criminal.
Yeah. No, it is devastating the United States, and it's certainly one of the things that you get when you leave the United States and you talk to people outside the United States is that our reputation is in the toilet. We've been completely trashed, and you know, Michael, excellent point, and thank you for the call. These guys are over the top, and they need to be called out. We need to continue to call them out, and you know, Robert Wexler is the only guy on the Judiciary Committee who's using this kind of language. And in fact, last week when he was talking to Scott McClellan, he came right out and he said, I hope that these revelations, Mr. McClellan, that you have laid out will lead to impeachment hearings here in the Judiciary Committee. And everybody else sat there silently. And of course, you had the Republicans, you know, attacking Scott McClellan. Oh, how dare he? He sold Bush out for 30 pieces of silver. Like what? George Bush is Jesus Christ? Well, according to the Republicans on the House Judiciary Committee, yes. And all the more the tragic it is. Oscar in Miami, Florida. Hey, Oscar, welcome to the show.
Oh, hello, Tom. Yeah, I hope you're having a great time there in Denmark.
So far, so good. I've been here about 24 hours so far.
Oh, great. Yeah, that's a wonderful, beautiful country. And really, look, if you can tell us also about the Index of Happiness, where can we find that on the internet? I'd be glad to search for that.
We'll have all the details on it. It'll be our Wednesday show, and we'll have the links up on our website.
Okay, great. Yeah, my question is this, or rather my comment and question. Obviously, we've seen that the Democratic Party at large, at the Congress, again, one more time, seems to be parting from the Constitution, and I'm really concerned about it. And what I wanted to say is that owing to this fact of the FISA legislation, what is really the impact of this legislation, if it is really that devastating? And on top of that, what's your take on the apparent Barack Obama's position or willingness to support this bill?
Yeah. Well, first of all, he said that recently he has said that he's going to work to get the telco immunity out of it. Some time ago, he said he would filibuster to get the immunity out of it. There are, to the best of my knowledge, two pieces to the bill. And let me put the caveat on here, Oscar, that I have not yet read this piece of legislation, but I have read and heard the commentaries of constitutional scholars who have read it, like Jonathan Turley on Keith Olbermann's program, and you know, there's a lot of stuff that you can find at Daily Kos, Think Progress, whatnot. That basically that there are two pieces to this. One is they're going to do away with the ability of people like you and me to participate in class action lawsuits against the telecommunications companies. Now, you know, these companies spent $13 million lobbying to get immunity. Why? Because class action lawsuits against them could cost them hundreds of millions of dollars. They broke the law, and they don't want to. Now, let's keep in mind, these are multi-billion-dollar companies. But still, hundreds of millions of dollars is not chump change, so they're willing to spend a few tens of millions of dollars to try and get immunity from that. Number one. Two, if they get that immunity, that means that the investigations aren't going to happen, the trials aren't going to happen, which would lead directly to the office of George W. Bush and Karl Rove and Dick Cheney and the whole bunch of them. So there's that part of it. There's the immunity part of it. And that's really the, you know, get out of free, jail free card for the big, large transnationals and the telco companies. The other part of it is that it opens the door. It doesn't throw it open entirely, but it opens the door to more spying on Americans without wiretaps, without warrants. Wiretapping Americans, listening, reading our emails, listening to our telephone conversations, presumably, even the next step, it could be, listening in, putting microphones in the wall of your home and listening to what's going on in your bedroom or your living room, et cetera, et cetera. And the whole idea that is, Oscar, thank you for the call, the whole idea that's enshrined in the Fourth Amendment, that basically a man's home is his castle or a woman's home is her castle, that we have privacy in our papers, in our possessions, and in our communications, it's out the window. I mean, it's not, with this piece of legislation, it's not entirely out the window, but it has broken down that bright line, that firewall that the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution provides for. And I'm confident that over time it would be overthrown unless John McCain becomes president and appoints three more Scalias to the Supreme Court. Big deal. 45. Big deal on this issue. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program.
You are listening to Tom Hartman.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour of, well, here in Copenhagen, Denmark, before the hour of 9 p.m. Welcome back. Tom Hartman with you live from Denmark and live in, what is it, New York, Ellen? Is that where you are?
Oh, I am in Mississippi today, actually.
In Mississippi? Oh, marvelous. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Are you down there with
with our project, yes.
Give us the very quick elevator speech on this. I want my listeners to know about it.
Well, our project is that we decided to build a community center. We actually went to the Y, who said to us, if we could build a swimming pool, that would be even more important, since probably roughly half the people would not maybe have died if they knew how to swim. Mm. And a lot of people just refuse to swim in the Gulf here because of the pollution.
Right.
And so we are building the first swimming pool in a 30-mile radius since the end of segregation, as well as a community center, a computer lab, all that kind of thing is going on here, and I am here to make sure that it happens.
Oh, that's absolutely wonderful, Ellen. Is there a website for people can learn more about
this? Well, there sort of is. It's the title of Sholene's book, ThroughTheEyeOfTheStorm.com. We have not updated it in a while, but you can see the design for the community center there again, ThroughTheEyeOfTheStorm.com. And we expect our swimming pool to be open by around the 1st of August somewhere.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So we're pretty excited about that.
That is absolutely wonderful. Congratulations. You do such great work.
But
Ellen,
and we've raised $1.5 million. Of course, we could always use more. But you know, this just shows you that storms are important to pay attention to. And I just stayed in a hotel last night, a Marriott, And they just opened at the end of May. It took them almost 3 years to open up this hotel. So, and they have the resources of Marriott, so that should give you some real perspective. Some Supreme Court decisions today. Very interesting ones. One was a guy who fought the county of Texas. He had records that showed him as a convict, as a former convict, even though he was not. And they got him with a firearm. They arrested him, stuck him in jail. He asked for an attorney. They did not give him one. And the issue is whether somebody can should have been given an attorney when they go directly to court. And the Supreme Court found 7-1, with only Justice Thomas disagreeing, that somebody should have an attorney given to them if they can't afford it as soon as they go before a judge.
I thought this was like, you know, I mean, doesn't the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution guarantee the right to a fair trial and
yes,
defense in your
trial
favor?
But in other words, he just went to judge for arraignment and wasn't given an attorney.
So the Supreme Court ruled that even in an arraignment, you're entitled to an attorney?
Apparently so. I haven't seen the exact language, and I'm not an attorney, but they said as soon as this was taken before a judge, which I imagine is arraignment, it should be allowed. You should be allowed to have an attorney.
That's pretty impressive for this court.
7-1.
That's the case. Wow. 7-1.
That's right.
I am looking forward to reading that decision. What else? By the way, speaking of courts, I noticed that the Bush administration just had a big loss that the federal district court for the first district, Washington, D.C.
This is a very interesting case. It's not a Supreme Court case, but it has to do with classification as an enemy combatant. And there was somebody that the Bush administration tried to classify as an enemy combatant, but he had not fought against the United States. They also could not come up with any real evidence against him. The only thing they could say is that he had ties to Al-Qaeda. Well, you know, somebody could have ties to Al-Qaeda by being married to somebody who's in Al-Qaeda. It doesn't mean you can put them in jail and throw away the key.
Right. So he was not, my sense of it.
They could not classify him as an enemy combatant.
Right. From what I read of the news story is because he was not carrying arms, he was therefore not a combatant.
Well, whatever reasons were, they said they did not have enough evidence. I think the arms may have been one of them, but I think there was just a whole host of things that they could not get him on.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, you can have ties to Al-Qaeda. It doesn't mean you're an enemy combatant. It doesn't mean you're anything.
Right. I have a feeling this is the beginning of a floodgate as a consequence of this most recent Supreme Court decision, because they've got all these guys in Guantanamo who are there not because they were terrorists, not because they were necessarily even bad guys, not because they necessarily even hated America. Some of them were actually working for us. But in many cases, because they had a brother-in-law who hated them and who was willing to take the bounties that we were paying that were equal to at least 2 years' worth of income in Afghanistan.
$5,000 at the very minimum.
Yeah, $5,000 bounty in a country where the average per capita income is less than $600 a year. That's like, I mean, the per capita income in the United States, the mean is $44,000. Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. It's incredible. So, you know, if you were offered $250,000 cash to turn in somebody you didn't like and you knew that you'd never see them again, there'd be no retribution, it would be anonymous. Well, you probably wouldn't. I probably wouldn't, but I guarantee you there are people who would, you know, even in our country.
Well, remember, they used to vote people in the 1800s in places like Vermont into Congress because they'd be out of town for the year, out of the state for most of the year.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
There was also another case where a guy got 10 years on drugs and firearms charge. The judge made a mistake and did not sentence him enough. And the lower court apparently increased his sentence. And six of the justices to three said, no, the court can only do what is asked of them. Even the prosecutor didn't ask for that. That was a very mixed group of people, both sort of right-wingers and left-wingers on that one.
Very interesting. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
And coming up Tuesday, as we continue to broadcast from Copenhagen, Denmark, I'll be challenging Henrik Vinslev, director of the National Laboratory for Sustainable Energy at the Technical University of Denmark, about why Denmark might just be the environmental savior of the planet. Plus, Dr. Lawrence Jung is going to be talking with us about realtors. Hey, don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there, get active. We'll see you tomorrow.
You are listening to Tom Hartman.
For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.